Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
The real voice behind the voices, Marnie Nixon, our guest today here on Crossover. I just have been reading your wonderful new book. I could have sung all night, and I probably could have read all night because it is really compelling. And it was like you were just retelling the story of the times. And I think that's what's so exciting about reading your book, starting from when you were very, very young and your career as it developed. And it is very, very exciting. And I just want to tell you that for anybody of a certain age, this is really a history book as well.
Oh, so, how wonderful.
Yes, you've set the stage. And I am amazed at how you remember so many, many things of when you were a child. I think I read somewhere that you had, your mother had saved a lot of things.
Yes, exactly. Right? My mother, first of all, yes, my mother kept a lot of records of a lot of things that the family did. She wrote down, before she died, she wrote down each one of the children's kind of chronological history and defined their life for us. It was really wonderful. But she all the time, with me anyway, she kept all the, every performance that I ever did, she kept the scrapbook, and then it gradually developed from there. And then I just went on myself keeping everything, all the clippings and things, and then that prompted, of course, memories of things that, I mean, there's always things that aren't there besides, and personal memories that related to certain things, and then my ghostwriter kind of helped me to define from this maze of things what he thought seemed to be the most important landmarks, and we went from there, and that prompted memories and talking with friends and things. So it was a long time in getting it together.
This was a very important thing that you did, writing your book. I can tell you that because I have known your name through the years, but as I say, I'm part of the multitude who thought of you as the person that was the voice behind various leading ladies in film. And, of course, I had no idea how involved you were with the contemporary scene, with opera, and I was in the business and still didn't know. So it's really wonderful that you have come out of the shadows here with this book, and it's so wonderfully written.
Thank you.
Really, you are an incredible person. Even to this day, you are so active, and your attitude towards life and reinventing yourself and keeping going and being at the top of your game. It's the kind of advice that is so important to give these days because people are living many lives in their lives.
That's interesting. Yes, it's good. It's good that you enjoy that.
But tell us all, you know, you were basically you grew up in the Hollywood, you know, the Hollywood mill there. I mean, you did a lot of work as a child actress or whatever you were doing there, singer. Is that right?
Yes. Well, we had a family orchestra, which was really the key to this whole thing. And we all learned to practice and to really develop our instruments. And that was just something we did in our family. It was, we were reading music before we read books. And making music together, and my mother was a teacher, and she was German and Polish. They came from Gdansk, mm-hmm. or Danzig, I think it was called at one point. And that European discipline was very prevalent in our house, and then, and that was just fun then, making the music, and then we started singing together, and realizing that we needed to make money for our lessons, because we weren't that rich, and we had to make our own way. So we began singing together, like the Trapp Family Singers, yes. I guess. And then gradually it just appeared that I was especially, you know, sort of talented in this way. And my younger sister and I began doing extra work in the movies. And then I started doing straight acting in various repertory companies as a kid. Just, I guess, because I was good at it and I could memorize the lines. And somebody told me they thought I was going to be a star because I had a very loud voice and I had large freckles. And so I could play brat parts. And it was then kind of a natural thing for me to fall into getting up from this. There was a training orchestra that we played in, my sisters and I, and then finally it was really limited to my younger sister and myself. And I would get up from that orchestra and sing arias. And
yes, I think you write about that.
Yeah.
But you also had studied violin, so you understood music, which is already an advantage for a singer.
Yes, exactly. And then I could just lay down my violin on the chair, you know, and get up from my very own orchestra and sing with, which was good experience. And then being around the Hollywood scene, of course, it was kind of a natural thing then to do extra work, and that work that got into bit parts. And but then I really was mainly in the classical musical scene during my teenagery. And came the shows and things that I did, and operas and chamber music.
So what's very fascinating is that you were all those composers that fled from Europe that became screen film composers, and the new scene. Of contemporary music, and you were involved in all that. And fascinating, you had worked or at least met with Stravinsky. Is that right?
Yes, and. That he was very instrumental in my growth. I think Roger Wagner, first of all, as a teenager, as yes. part of the chorale and getting a lot of oratorio experience that way as a soloist and also a chorus member. And then there was Leonard Stein, who was my piano teacher at Los Angeles City College, and he was a part of the Monday evening concerts,
yes.
or concerts on the roof.
Right.
And this Concerts on the Roof was everybody that was a musician, the intelligentsia yeah. of Los mm-hmm. Angeles would go there to Peter Yates's house and listen to this new music, and all the composers would write new music and have it read through by the best musicians. It's quite unique. And Leonard introduced me to this group of people, and then he introduced me to Igor Stravinsky, and then I began recording a lot of his chamber works and doing a lot of things with him, conducting his operas and oratorios and cantatas. And it was very heady.
Heavy, heady, and also difficult. I mean, I think that singers really were confronted with some very, very difficult music.
Yes.
When they were in that genre.
Right.
But as I say, this is all quite a surprise, because I don't think the world really knows that you were such a serious singer, that you had really contemplated a career in opera as well.
Oh, sure. And I had done, I think by the time I was 21, I had done, I think, about 22 operas already.
Yeah, but I mean, you were really doing it. This
yeah.
is, and you went to Tanglewood, of course, you were there. But when you started doing this dubbing, which was really, again, an opportunity, I guess, to make some money, you know, you didn't just sing the complete song, did you? I mean, or did you do pieces, or did, for instance, in The King and I, did Deborah Carr sing at all?
No. No, it was all me, except for a few of the lead-ins in the verses. Like she says, in the beginning of Getting to Know You, she speaks.
Yes.
She says, it's a very ancient saying, but a true and honest thought, that when you become a teacher, by your pupils you'll be taught. And then
right.
I continue that, and it's mm-hmm. me. As a teacher, I've been learning, you know, and then it goes into the singing.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of pitched the voice so it just sounded like it was an extension of her own voice.
That's absolutely, I was just going to say that, because you really got the quality of her voice. There was, it's such an incredible match.
In all the things that I've dubbed, but especially in The King and I, we worked quite extensively to, of course, acquire that. I mean, I tried to stretch my voice into the actress's mouth, so to speak.
Yeah, but you really got a quality in there. There's a kind of a vulnerability in her voice and something. It's really quite amazing. Now, with West Side Story, you dubbed Natalie Wood, is that right?
Yes.
That's a whole different character.
Right. And that was a little bit different because it wasn't organized as well as The King and I. In The King and I really... You know, we really worked together and sang the songs together and walked through the scenes together, both singing the same songs, looking at each other, taking from each other what we needed. And I really learned a lot about acting that way, because she was able to tell me her subtext and what she thought, and I could see mm-hmm. what she was doing and how she was approaching the song. But in the West Side Story, I wasn't able to do that with Natalie Wood, because she was not, she was a little insecure about being dubbed, and she didn't know how much of her voice was going to be used, and she didn't share with that personally at all. I wasn't able to work with her in any voice lessons or coaching sessions or anything, but I had to do it by secondary means, by the coach, who would record her sessions, and then he would play me that recording, and then we would make a recording ourselves and work it out together, and then we went to record the songs, but then she would record the complete songs, and then I would record the complete songs, and they said that they were going to then combine them electronically, which, of course, I didn't think was possible. And
did you meet with Bernstein at all during that?
Well, Bernstein, I had already done many concerts with in New York City, but he wasn't on the set for the picture at all.
Now, with My Fair Lady, that hurt a lot of people, I think, including Julie Andrews. I think she was terribly shocked that she never even got to do the film, of course.
Right.
How was Audrey Hepburn to work with? She's a brilliant actress.
Audrey Hepburn was an adorable person. She was very witty and very charming and very sophisticated and thoughtful and aristocratic mm-hmm. in her approach. She would never say anything to hurt anyone, and but she was also very honest, and she was very objective about her own voice. She could tell when she really wasn't doing it the way it should be sounding.
Now, did she sing any part of that?
She actually recorded Wouldn't It Be Loverly to her own track, and I mean, she filmed that to her own track.
Mm-hmm.
And then she would go back into the studio and film some of the other songs that she sang, record the soundtrack before she filmed it, to keep re-recording things that she had learned how to sing better and better. But in the end, it was all my voice, except for the beginning of just you wait, Enrique, just you wait, Enrique, is that part,
uh-huh.
is all hers.
Uh-huh.
And just the lead-in on the rain in Spain.
Mm-hmm. Is her.
That was her.
So when did they allow you to tell the world that you were dubbing? At one point, I think it was, weren't you kind of threatened? And if you ever tell anybody that, you know, you dubbed this, whatever.
Yes. Yes, the 20th Century Fox, the publicity department called me one day and threatened me and said that if anyone ever found out that I did any part of the dubbing for Deborah Carr, that they would see to it that I wouldn't work in town again. And it was like the mafia or something.
Yeah.
It was very frightening. And it's funny, I was talking to somebody last night. I've been doing my show here in Hollywood, my one-woman show. And there was a publicist that came up to me, and she said that around that time she had interviewed Deborah Carr, and she said that she said, "Did you know that Marnie Nixon was threatened and was told that she was not going to get credit and that she shouldn't say anything?" And Deborah herself said to her, "Well, that's nonsense. I didn't know that she had that they had told her that, and I don't need to know that, and I think she should get credit because she's wonderful," or something like that.
Yeah.
It was very sweet.
Well, she's still alive.
Yeah, she's still alive, but she's not very well.
I remember seeing her some years back. I think it was one of the Oscar, you know.
Yes, at the Academy.
And she came out, and I know she was very nervous, but she looked very beautiful. And
yes, she still looked beautiful. She has Parkinson's.
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah. So now, as an aside, you're doing a one-woman show now. Will we be seeing that here in New York?
I don't know. I'm hoping so. I've been doing this show. It's called the Marnie Nixon, The Voice of Hollywood, in various places all over the country. I've been doing it here at Theater West, and then I'm going up to Seattle, and then I'm going down to Florida, to Naples,
mm-hmm.
Florida, to do it. And I've been doing it in various places in the East. And I tried to get it on the boards in New York about 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and nobody seemed to be interested in wanting to produce it. But I think the times have changed, and I think there is talk now that I can bring it to New York.
Well, bring it to Philadelphia, at least.
Oh, yes, I would like to. I hear that the MacArthur Theater, I think it is.
That's in Princeton, New Jersey.
Good.
Yeah. So now your life, you know, has evolved, and I think that people in the arts and people that have had, you've worked very, very hard. And it certainly appears that way when, you know, starting even as a child and developed many, many facets of your career. And you're still doing, are you doing drama at all? Are you doing any television now?
Well, yes, as much as I can. I had to do this particular tour. I had to turn down a part in a film, which was very disappointing to me, but it was not that, you know, it wasn't that great a part, but I really would like to do much more film and much more television.
You were on Law and Order, is that right?
Yes, and I've had guest appearances on, oh, various shows over the years, The Mothers-in-Law and Law and Order I've done,
What kind of roles are they? Are they straight drama, or are
yes.
you supposed to be an ex-actress? Or
yes, just the acting roles.
Yeah, just straight. And, of course, you had that ability as well. I mean, you were really a triple threat there. You played violin, you sang, you acted. I guess you danced, too, right?
Well, not really.
But also, you're very open about your life and you know, the disappointments personally. And am I right? Did Ernest Gold write Exodus?
Yes.
Yeah, because I had very good friends who got a tremendous big hit record out of that, Arthur Ferranti and Lou Teicher.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that was their big one.
Yes.
That's tremendous, yeah.
Yes. Well, yes, I mean, the song which Pat Boone wrote the lyrics to.
Oh, that's kind of out.
Yes, is very, you know, it's still doing very well. And it's a great song, and the score was absolutely wonderful. And Ernest wrote a lot of nice scores for Stanley Kramer, Mad Mad World, On the Beach, and...
Well, there was that period, of course, I guess. What was that, the 50s, late 50s, 60s?
Yes.
Yeah. Of course, you have wonderful children, and you're very family-oriented. I see that, you know, from what I have certainly gotten from the book, you maintained a career, and you wrote, you know, you were close with your family.
Yes, and now I still am very close to my family, and they are just wonderful. They're all here in the Los Angeles area, and even though I don't choose to live in Los Angeles, I try to visit quite often.
Has the business changed much? All of it?
Well, which business?
Well, that's what I'm saying, all of it, because certainly Hollywood isn't the same. The process isn't the same. You don't have the big studios. Broadway isn't the same.
No.
And certainly theater isn't the same either. I think people that choose to go into the business, which is all encompassing, realize that it's not the same as
yes.
it was 40 years ago, certainly.
Yes, one keeps saying it's a shame, but I guess it's a matter of survival and, the thing that I think is really a horror story is that people are not being given music in the schools. They're not developing musical talent or musical appreciation
mm-hmm.
or the history of music. And people have to do that on their own. And it's not like in the culture. So that obviously the audiences are going to be different. And then they... In order to survive, the presentations, the plays, the musicals, even the operas have to really develop audiences.
And a lot of musicals are being redone. I think that they're running out of fresh material. They're doing
yes, and the creative talent is not being nurtured and supported. And it's all about business, and mm-hmm. a lot of the business people are not, they don't have an appreciation of the arts.
Yes.
So the whole feeling tone is not what it used to be, and yet mm-hmm. I think it's up to the artists, of course, to, they have to survive, they have to be able to go with the commercial things in order to stay in the game. The game has to stay there, but one has to then define it, and you have to keep your own feeling of what is really good prevalent so that you can present that and make it presentable so people will, because once they see it, they will feel it, they will respond to it. But it's making sure that it's seen. That's the problem.
Well, I think you were very lucky to have flowered in the environment that you did at the time, because you were really there at a marvelous time. Now, you're still giving master classes, is that right?
Yes, I give master classes, and I'm asked to do a lot of things with classical singers who want to sing music theater.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a kind of a new form of teaching nowadays. I've been fighting for this all my life for the departments of the universities to realize that the drama department and the music departments have to start having a dialogue together. They can't just piece them off, because a complete performer has to have knowledge of all of it. And they can't just be so exclusive. And they have to understand and respect each other's focus. And nowadays, when I teach, most of my singers, I really make them aware of they have to be classically trained. They really have to develop muscles so they can maintain their voices through all the different kinds of singing that they have to do, which is a different style, not only just musically, but it's also a style of tone. And yet your voice has to be continually stretched and ready to go in any direction. As what's happening on the Broadway stage now in the musicals, you have the operatically conceived shows like Light in the Piazza.
Or even, I think, Phantom of the Opera. I mean, some of the Weber things, I think, are very demanding, aren't they?
Yes, but vocally, I think it's even getting more so in Light in the Piazza and Sondheim things.
Yes, the Sondheim things always. Well,
and complicated, and even Bernstein. You know, West Side Story is
sure.
Not easy to do. The rhythmical patterns are very unusual, and yet on Broadway, to sustain yourself, you have to be able to belt also.
Yeah.
You have to be able to do, like, you know, Rent or Aida.
Sure.
It's different kind of popular singing, or Mamma Mia, that kind of show. But then you have the operatically conceived things that cannot be sung with real pharyngeal, you know, full-out, big, huge, operatic, grand opera style of voices. It has to be done in a more vernacular style.
You know what's interesting? Some of the big singers, certainly the sopranos anyway, have tried to make albums of pop tunes like Vernon Duke or, you know, things like that. And it doesn't work. I mean, no matter how great they are, it never worked, but it still doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, we used to laugh at it when Lawrence Tibbett sang or something like that. But even now, you know, I really think they try, because they're great singers. Some of them does not work. And it's a very, very different expertise.
Right. So a lot of the times the master classes now, the universities and the colleges have me there to help the teachers and also help the students to understand the style. The students sometimes understand it more than the teachers, because the teachers have been so trained in classical style. And yet it's now broadening into that, and I can be helpful that way, and it's really wonderful, because also you have to be an actress to do it. You have to fulfill the acting intent, and that's why they have to be trained as actors and singers.
So it's an enormous, enormous job, but you, Marnie Nixon, are the link to the past and probably the hope of the future as well. And I can't tell you how thrilling it's been to speak with you and to read your book. It's I hope that it's selling well. It's certainly fascinating.
Well, thank you. And I was particularly open about my private life.
Yes,
and
you were.
And the things, because I think also we need nowadays to share each other with each other, so we don't feel alone. We're not inundated by machines, and we're still human beings here.
Yes, and I think when you put it in the perspective of those times, I've always said the sexual revolution was for the parents, not for the children of that generation, because one grew up in a very restricted moral atmosphere. I mean, things were going on, but I think we were all very, very protected. And of course, it's a whole different attitude now. And to hear about you and what you did at that time and how you've survived through a lot of very traumatic experiences and still maintained a good attitude and a strong family, you know, center. And you're keeping on going, and I think it's a very inspiring book, and I am delighted to have spoken with you about it.
Oh, thank you so much.
Marnie Nixon, our guest today on Crossover. I'm Jill Pasternak. Until next time.